Hi, this is Rizal Januk, and you're listening into the Handsome Trinity Express.
Well, hello, dear reader, and hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 16 of the Handsome Trinity Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show, an awesome podcast you could find on iTunes, and The Chronic Rift, a series of podcasts that try to explore the culture in pop culture. You can find me and a ton of other great podcasts over at www.chronicrift.com. I want to thank everybody for the great feedback and sharing and retweeting and just spreading the word on the pretty insightful and fantastic interview last week with Ron Greenfield. Thanks very much for spreading the word. This week, super exciting, just in time for Halloween. When I started this venture, this is one of the first like two or three people I thought of. I was like, I got to ask my guest today to be on the show. The reason why we're putting him on hum now is because he very excitingly has just released a brand new comic book, so we did the show to tie in with that a bit. Mr. Steven Skaya is a professional television and film writer. For those who remember the Mike Sunday interview, he's the fellow that got me and Mike Sunday together and started that friendship. In addition to being an Austin Film Festival winner, Steven and his writing partner Matthew Fetterman have written for television shows like Judging Amy, Jericho, Warehouse 13, and Human Target. They also are film writers, including the newest Zorro and Ghost Recon from Michael Bay, coming soon to a theater near you, and a brand new comic book from Darby Pop Publishing called Dead Squad. So welcome to the Handsome Trinity Express, Steven Skaya.
It is a true honor to be here, Tim Davis.
Oh, you're honoring me. So now, one of the things that's interesting about Dead Squad, and you guys are also developing a television show called Pax Romana,
mm-hmm.
which is based upon a graphic novel.
True.
And yeah. Now you guys are writing your own comic book. How did the comic book kind of come about?
Well, what had happened originally was we had had this idea and it had been kicking around for a long time in our heads of what the sort of like the existential action movie would be like. So often you just see those movies where the awesome good guys are shooting the terrible bad guys and no one thinks about the consequences of doing that. And we had been working on the show one time with a guy who did it for a living. He was a real special forces soldier, ex-special forces soldier. And one night we were kind of staying late in the office and chatting with him, and he let his guard down a little bit and was talking about how, I wonder if at the end of the day, when our main character is sort of like lying in bed, staring at the ceiling, if he did the right thing, of all the people he took out over time. And we realized at this point, the guy is not talking about the guy on the show. He's talking about himself. And that was really interesting to talk about what it would be like to be a guy who's kind of spent your life doing that and wonder kind of at the end of the day, whether you're doing the right thing or the wrong thing. And that sort of stuck in the back of our heads for a long time. And then we're also really sort of into technology and sort of the Wired article aspect of storytelling, where you read something interesting or see something cool on 60 Minutes. And we were reading about how all of the modern medical advances has happened first on the battlefield, starting all the way back with, I think it was anesthesia in the Crimean War, and how every war has its own distinct technological advance. And we feel like the next one would be something cool like nanotechnology, where they're able to actually like insert tiny little nanobots into you to repair arteries and keep your heart beating. And so we kind of took that premise and smushed it together with the existential crisis of, have I done the right thing? And that's what Dead Squad became. It became a story about a group of guys who realized they're maybe on the wrong side of the law. Right before they're killed dead, and when they wake up, they all have a very different experience of whether or not it was real or not, the afterlife. So, and the story goes from there.
Looking at things like Walking Dead and stuff like that, and you guys are developing Pax Romana, which we'll talk about in a bit. Was this a type of story that you guys tried to get a script off the ground and weren't finding avenues, or so you decided to do a comic book almost as hopefully as a backdoor pilot, or were you like, no, this is really much more for the comic genre? Because comic books and graphic novels really are exploring that deep existential stuff these days.
Yeah, for sure. And a lot of the really interesting stuff these days is in comics. And so it's really great to be doing a comic because you can really do stuff like that, where in TV and film, it becomes a little bit more of marketing centric. And that was kind of the problem we had. I know we started a long, this idea is, it's been an idea of ours for a long time. And I think it started as a TV show idea, then it morphed into a movie idea, and then the resistance we got when we took it out as a movie idea was we had producers really interested in it, but the studios thought it was a great idea. They just didn't know how to market it because it's got all the action and shit exploding. Am I allowed to say shit on the podcast?
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Shit explodes, but then there's also that little bit of an element of, like, our main character, when he wakes up, he refuses to kill anybody because he's convinced he saw hell and doesn't want to go back there. And now he's non-lethal, and the rest of the team has no problem. And so it's a lot of them sort of fighting between them about how to do their jobs effectively. And that's interesting to us, but it's terrifying to a marketing department.
Yeah, and you know what's weird to me? This is not meant as any sort of Hollywood bashing. I love Hollywood, and it just sounds like this weird, strange perception becoming reality thing, because if you look at a movie like Die Hard, one of the things that makes that movie so special and people forget is that, like, John McClane cries. And the movie's really about a man trying to save his marriage, not trying to blow away Hans Gruber. And it strikes me as a bit odd because there really is plenty of room in content for those kind of themes. But I guess it sounds like a lot of folks don't really know how to sell that.
I you know, it's not that they don't necessarily know how to sell it. I think that they're looking for the thing that is 20% different than what they've been selling because there's a certain safety there. And I understand that where it's a business first.
Sure.
And even something like Die Hard, which is arguably one of the greatest action movies of all time, was a happy accident. And we've talked about the story of Die Hard before, right? And how that's a Frank Sinatra movie. And
it was for the listeners.
Yeah.
You can flesh it out a little bit. But
okay, so... okay, help me out here, but if I remember correctly, it's based on an old Roderick Thorpe novel, right?
High Rise.
He's like an old hard-boiled novelist, and Sinatra optioned one of his books in the late 60s, and that became The Detective. And that character in The Detective then, in a subsequent book, went on to have the Nakatomi Plaza adventure. And that was optioned by Fox, and it was being developed for him to star in, and it was going to be this sort of, like, great old Lee Marvin, badass old guy. Instead of his wife, it's his daughter that he's going to visit at Christmas time, and it's basically the same thing, but with, you know, 70-year-old Frank Sinatra sort of Liam Neesoning his way through the story. And at a certain point, he's like, guys, I'm too old for this. I just don't have an interest in doing this anymore. And they were far enough down the road they wanted to make the movie, and they couldn't get any of the big action stars because they had no money for it. And they settled on Bruce Willis. It was like, he'll be fine. It won't be expensive. It'll, you know, we'll get through it. And then next thing you know, it creates almost an entire genre. I can't tell you how many rooms I've been in where someone asks for, you know, Die Hard and a blank.
Yeah.
Still.
Absolutely. And, well, it's funny because you said Dead Squad took a long time to get off the ground, but,
yeah.
But, is there though a chance though, when you do a comic book like this, when you turn to another genre and, you know, you just had issue one dropped, earlier in October, issue two is coming out in November, I'm assuming, or sooner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a monthly comic. So, and then, you know, presumably there may even be a collection formed of the first 10 or 15 issues.
We'll do a graphic novel.
Exactly.
For sure.
When it becomes three-dimensional like that, is that something you could then, like, revisit with certain studios and places where they can read it and go, oh, I see what you guys are doing?
Absolutely. And I think something that's really great about the graphic novel genre that you don't get in any form, you know, in books especially, is the ability to see it come to life visually. And you can cast the comic with your favorite actors. Is like, he looks kind of like so-and-so, and she looks kind of like so-and-so. And you can build it like that. I mean, that's Sam Jackson got the job as Nick Fury because when they were reimagining the Ultimates, someone said, wouldn't it be awesome if Nick Fury was played by Sam Jackson? So they drew Sam Jackson as Nick Fury. And then he, you know, it was such a success that they're like, yeah, of course, that's who you cast.
Yeah, and I think it's really, there's a lot of changes happening in the business nowadays, and when you look at, you know, there seems to be a pretty decent resurgence of indie films, shorts that are available digitally. You know, we had Garcia on, was talking a lot about how there's all these new avenues for people to make shorts and festivals and things, and I think it's actually a really exciting time of almost backdoor opportunity and sneak attack opportunity and things of, like, because everyone's like, Hollywood is, you know... It's hard to get through the gatekeepers. It's hard to get people to buy your stuff. Hollywood is filled with lots of no's, 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 no's. But comic books, graphic novels are now giving you guys, well, us, all of us, the listeners who want to write scripts and stuff, new ways to say, well, I know you said no last week, but take a look at this now. I think it's exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And the stuff that gets me most excited creatively generally comes from graphic novels these days, because so much of my business is adapting IP, intellectual property. So yeah. It's a lot of meetings where they've got a YA novel, or they've got a video game, or they've got a graphic novel. And the graphic novels I tend to gravitate towards just because I'm very visual, and I really like seeing those stories played out from beginning to middle and end. And also they get to sort of take their time in the way like a good cable show can know, they know they've got 9 episodes to make their story work, and so they sparse out the story. Whereas in network television, sometimes I feel like you're sort of stuck in the system of every week the ratings matter.
Yeah.
And so you need to front load everything, and it makes the very beginning of the show feel so full, but also a little top heavy, and it doesn't maybe get the same room to grow that a cable show can get sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not even, you know, there's plenty of great network shows on network TV. I mean, you've done, you know, Jericho was extraordinarily popular and a really, really well thought out, and a show that did make you think afterwards of like, man, well, you know, one of the things I liked about Jericho was you. That's the type of show you couldn't help but be like, well, what would I do in that town?
Right.
What would I do when that walked into me? So it's there is room for that, but you're right. The pressures of network TV, of having to deliver 8 to 10 million viewers, sell Coca-Cola ads and Budweiser ads, it's enormous pressure that you don't have in cable and graphic novels.
Yeah. And by the way, please don't get me wrong, because it's not worse. It's not better. It's just very different. And I like that. Like, Fetterman and I are always jumping between, if we can, jumping between film, which, you know, as we talked about, it can take, 10 years to get a movie off the ground, where cable then doesn't take that long, but it doesn't have the immediacy that broadcast does, where you need to have new programming every fall, and it's a cannon that you're just going to reload and fire, and there's so much triage, and it happens very quickly, and it's exciting to be in that every once in a while, and then take a step out, and then work in cable, and then take a step out and work in film, and you could be doing a couple things all at once, because they're all on very different timetables, and creatively it's great. As a writer, you know, when you can work on a bunch of different things that sort of use different gears in your brain. Not only is it good to not kind of get jammed up on one idea in your head, but also it kind of keeps you loose. Like, if I were a guy who worked out more, it's like they say, like, oh, one day is, you know, legs, the other day is upper body. And it's like, that's what it feels like to me when it's working really well.
Well, I know exactly what you mean with the workout metaphor, Steve. I know exactly what you're talking about. But it's also cool, like, in network, I'm really excited by shows like The Blacklist and Hannibal and Extant. Yeah. You know, network has to be kind of safe. I'm a big fan of Last Man Standing with Tim Allen, because it is that old school multi-cam sitcom that we grew up on. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And they actually do talk about current events and push the envelope a bit, but it's a very safe show. And what's wrong with that? But I do like that networks are tackling Hannibal. I was like, Hannibal on network TV? Oh my God. And it's brilliant. But anyway, let's talk about you. I want to go back to something you said a second ago, which is you guys do a lot of adapting of intellectual property. Let's talk about, am I saying it right, Pax Romana?
Yeah, Pax Romana is how I would say it. But
Pax Romana, yeah. I'm not fluent in the Latin, so.
Wait, you didn't take years of Latin like I did in Catholic school?
Yeah, no, I'm too busy in the legs and chest, you know, working out. Working out.
You're an Adonis, Tim.
Hey, you said it. Dear viewer, Steve Sky and I have known each other for 20 years, so hopefully we won't get too
inside. And by the way, you can use that on the front page of the website where it's like, he's an Adonis,
Steve Sky. Okay, perfect. But I'm curious to talk about the idea of the – I think it's so interesting that you guys have adapted now a very thoughtful, very intelligent – also, the material of Pax Romana is also a bit existential in a military sense.
And very, very different than what we – in its current form that we've adapted it into.
So is there like a timeline there of like where you guys had developed Dead Squad?
Yeah,
like you said, in various permutations. But when you were doing Pax Romana, which is for Sci-Fi Channel, was that an experience that said, "Hey, let's do Dead Squad"? Like, I'm trying to get to how the experience of adapting something ties in and relates to the idea of creating something from scratch. But that's kind of in the same wheelhouse, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's funny because I think of an adaptation and original material in that same way I think about TV versus features or broadcast TV versus cable, where it just gives your brain a different thing to think about. Mm-hmm. And when you're adapting something, you're using a different part of your story brain because there's so much that stuff that's there already. And you want to be sure that you are faithful to the material that's there. So we'll take Zorro, for example.
Okay, perfect.
There's a character that everyone knows, and there was a book that we were given that they wanted to be the adaptation that they used. And we said, okay, here are the things that we know Zorro needs. He needs the black outfit. He needs the hat. He needs the mask. He needs the sword. He needs the horse. And everything else is up for debate. You don't necessarily need all of the things that the book had, because the book needs to work on its own. A novel works differently than a video game, works differently than a movie works. And the things that make those structurally work are not necessarily what you have in every other version of it. So we took all the pieces we needed, we put everything else up on a shelf, and it was there to be grabbed when we needed those bits and pieces, but we also weren't afraid to sort of develop new ways to get to the story structure that we knew we needed and all that. And Pax Romana was another great example of that, because the graphic novel itself is awesome, but it's very different than what we ended up doing. And that was partly because of our own process with me and Matt, and also with Circle of Confusion, who are the producers, knowing that the comic itself is the story of a group of special forces mercenaries who go back in time with the Catholic Church to reset the world / religion. We tried a version with the Catholic Church. It didn't quite work the way we wanted it to, so we took the Catholic Church out, and we put a new thing in, and it works better now for what our needs are. It doesn't make the book any less awesome. It's almost like an Elseworlds version of it.
Right.
That even when we're told, when Hickman, the guy who wrote the graphic novel, read it, he didn't hate it, which was very flattering.
That's a plus.
Terrified.
Yeah.
Because he's a great writer who we look up to quite a lot, and his biggest note was on a character we created, and it was a good note. And okay. So it's exciting when even the creator himself can read it and see what we're going for and understand the changes we make, because the needs of the television show or the miniseries are different than the graphic novel itself.
Now, when you make a big change like that, the comic book, don't get excited, listeners, but the comic book fan is a very particular, persnickety audience.
Yeah, yeah.
How much concern do you have for that? Like, because I imagine it's got to be discussed of like, okay, if we do this, people may totally shit on it. But then again, we may just have to bite the bullet and say, no, give it a chance. This is the right move to make.
I think it's the second thing. Because I'm a nerd. I'm a fan first. Whenever I approach anything, it's would I want to even see this? And so when we come up with a thing, we can listen sort of like tonally as like, is this right? Are we changing it too much? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the Zorro we developed was the Zorro that was Zorro in the 1800s, you know, fighting wealthy Spanish landowners. It wasn't Space Zorro with lightsabers. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah,
that
sure.
Felt too far for us. We actually like that character and what he represents, and how he's sort of the granddaddy of all adventure heroes. And Pax was the same thing. It was, we love this story, and it's fascinating that the Vatican would send a team back in time to reset religion, but we also know that not everyone feels that way, and so we got to take the essence of what that is, which is, if the world's going to end and you can go back in time and reset it, who's the guy that's going to do it? And it's not the Catholic Church. It's, you know, someone more like Steve Jobs or Elon Musk. And to us, that's really interesting. And now you've got a whole new thread to follow with a whole new interesting character and a whole new way to develop a story.
I can't help but think of Apocalypse Now when you're saying that. And I know it's not the same story, but it's just what you're describing there with the essence of the story with, you know, Apocalypse Now is Heart of Darkness.
Yeah,
but in a totally different thing. I'd love to talk about, or if you wouldn't mind expanding a little bit on breaking down to that essence, because one of the best things that Stephen Sky is good at, dear listener, for those who don't know him, is no, you really do know how to take what looks like a super complicated, super layered, like, oh my God, how did they come up with that? And you know how to take that and be like, wait a second, hold on. Let's do this character in like three sentences, or, you know, break it down to their core essence. And that sounds like possibly maybe even the most vital, like is that the thing that's maybe the most vital in adapting and the thing that kind of keeps you guys sane within the material?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thank you. That's very flattering of you to say. And I think, you know, for anyone who wants to, who's kind of on their own journey as a writer, it's a good skill to have because as a professional writer, you are always trying to keep your ideas as complex in your mind, but as simple to explain when they come out of your mouth as possible. Yeah. So people can understand it, but also emotionally feel what you're talking about very quickly. And the ability to do that, I think, like you take the essence of any good character is it's a really simple explanation of what they want and the problem they have getting it. And for like Die Hard, for example, John McClane is not a complicated guy. His problem is that he is a hero to a fault. Mm-hmm. And that is the most important thing in his life. And that's why Die Hard is an interesting movie, because it's not just a guy running around shooting bad guys. It is the story of a guy who has made the choice to make his job the most important thing, which is why he's not with his wife, which is why when he comes to her, he's got a chip on his shoulder. And it's all about his story of redemption, of realizing, oh, this relationship matters more than my job. But in this one perfect moment, it's awesome to watch because the two things are the same thing for those 2 hours of the movie. It is my relationship is the most important thing, and all the skill I have used as being John McClane, badass cop who doesn't play by their rules, is what I'm going to use to accomplish my goal. And that's great.
There's two movies I'd love to just mention real quick that pull the ultimate bait and switch, I think, when it comes to, oh my God, this is actually about a really tender, loving relationship that you don't realize when you watch it the first maybe 3 or 4 times. I mean, you and I watch movies like 10 times,
right?
You know, but one is, and I just watched it the other day, is the original Rocky.
Yeah.
And I can, that movie is 90% Rocky and Adrian.
Yeah.
Like a lot. I like knew it was an important part of the movie, but watching it again, I'm like, this is all about him and Adrian, to the point where I'm like, that fight is just sort of like the dessert.
Yeah, and that's why it's funny when you think of it like a boxing movie, it's almost like you're not giving it the credit it deserves,
yeah,
because it's so much more than that. And the boxing isn't until act 3, right? I mean, there's a little bit of like he's in the gym and shit, but there's no like it's a boxing match.
Their redemption. Well, the other thing too is like he's not that good a trainer. Adrian is the fire that inspires him, and I mean,
yeah,
I've seen Rocky 20 goddamn times.
Yeah,
and I'm watching it last Saturday night, and that's what I do, dear reader. And I've seen this movie 20 times, and he's screaming, "Yo, Adrian!" I got tears in my eyes.
Yeah, and I'll tell you exactly why. It is a masterfully made movie because even though we as guys go to that movie to see boxing because boxing is cool and interesting or whatever, anyone can get something out of it, because if you break that movie down, all of its big story movements are all on the relationship, not on the plot of him as a boxer. So
exactly.
I bet you if you break it down, let's see, the first he's down on his luck. Then page 15 is he always wished he could be a boxer, but that's not where the story turns. It's when he sees Adrian.
Yeah.
They go on the date. They fall in love. That's the middle part of the story. And now he's going to jeopardize that new relationship that he has to go box. And Mickey doesn't want him to do it. And everyone's telling him not to. But he knows this is the thing he needs to do to be worthy of the love.
You
know what I mean?
Like, yeah. That's the thing. He's not good enough for Adrian until he goes 15 rounds with the champ. Then he can say, "I love you, Adrian." And you're the...
And he doesn't need to win.
No, he does. And he doesn't win. People forget that. Rocky,
that's why
loses.
You cry when when he yells for Adrian, not when the bell goes off at the end of the match.
Yeah. And one of the things that's so like, and I love stuff like this. It's actually the movie begins. He has a fight. He gets a piss poor payday. And he's walking up the street, and you don't realize it at the time. He's walking up the street and looks in the window of a pet shop. It's just a normal old shot. But mm-hmm. You then realize, oh, that's Adrian's pet shop. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, the attention to detail is great. I want to throw another one at you, especially from a screenplay point of view. And screenwriters out there, this is a screenplay I highly recommend everybody should read, and it's Jim Cameron's Aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know when the last time you read it was, Steve, but what Cameron does that's just so brilliant is he fills, like, the first act is all about guns, and plasma rifles and exo spacesuits and explosions. And I mean, I counted, I think there's 15 or 17 explosion, the word explosion, in the script, in big caps. I mean, plenty of buildings blowing up and all that. So if you're a producer, we talk about the commercial, you know, commercial concerns.
Right.
So you're 20th Century Fox and you're reading Jim Cameron's script. You are just seeing explosion, big rifle, soldiers in danger. And so you're reading it going, ah, okay,
macho.
Great. But then if you really read it like a screen, you know, if you take a deep read of it, it's all about Ripley and Newt.
Yeah.
And it is this sweet story of this woman trying to become a mother again.
And that's why Jim Cameron is one of the best ever, because his movies, they trick you into thinking they're about awesomeness when they're actually about a really small story. So Terminator 2 is this big, ridiculous story about two, you know, robots from the future fighting each other to kill a little boy. But the story that you care about is the Pinocchio story.
Yep.
It's John teaching the Terminator to be a human. And by the way, the Terminator teaching John how to be a good leader.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, you almost get mad at him. Like, oh, Cameron. Now, but let's talk about this, though, from like a page, you know, the blank page perspective, if we can. Because I know, you know, you and I both love... I write much more just straight dramas than you do. I don't write a lot of action stuff. But at the same time, you and I could sit around and talk about the Millennium Falcon all day. We love explosions and we love battle scenes. We love all that stuff. How do you think, like, do you ever have those instances where you and Matt are like, oh man, I got a great battle scene and I don't know what it is yet. Like the character, motivations for you. Like I got the boxing fight, but I don't necessarily have Stallone and Adrian yet. Is that necessarily, like, do you guys create a tool chest of like, man, this would be some great scenes, and sometimes almost start with that as opposed to, and then add in the characters later. Like, how do you find that balance from the blank page going on?
Because there's two of us, and things generally need to work between the two of us before we can put them on paper and make them work for other people, we'll talk a lot about structure at first. And, you know, after, you know, 10 years of doing this, you really sort of get a feel for what needs to go where just in your own. After your 10,000 hours, you just get that sixth sense of, like, where things need to go. And what's great is that, you know, Matt is a really good structure writer, but he's also got a really good emotional core where he knows, okay, structurally we need this thing, but also we need to be feeling this certain thing at this point. And I'm a really emotional person and writer too. And so when he says it and I'm feeling, he's telling me the thing and I'm feeling what he's telling me about, we know it's right. And then sometimes it, you know, it, when it isn't quite locking in, one of us will be telling the other, no, you're supposed to be feeling this way in the scene. And the other one's saying back, like, look, I see all the stuff that's happening structurally, but I'm not feeling the thing I think I'm supposed to be feeling here. And over the years, we sort of developed a shorthand for how to triage those moments where, a good example is on Human Target, we had a character who everyone was supposed to immediately like. And it was really hard because there wasn't a lot of time to get to know the character before you had to like him and want to root for him in this one episode. And one of the writers said very smartly, he needs a dog. He needs a thing that he cares about, so we care about him because this thing loves him and he loves this thing back. But we were in the middle of sort of a big giant action plot where he was running through a building with the Human Target and there wasn't room for a dog. And by the way, shooting with a dog is a production nightmare.
Yeah.
So we gave him a goldfish and he carried a goldfish with him throughout the whole episode. And it made him instantly likable because now everything he's doing carrying around a goldfish that he cares more about than himself. So you get the sense that this character is not escaping the danger for himself. He's escaping the danger for the goldfish. And it's just a really tiny, subtle thing that makes a big difference when you want to get behind someone and care about the thing they're doing. Just like when Rocky is in that fight and you don't care whether he wins or not because you know he is doing it for something bigger than that.
Right. And Rocky had two pet turtles that he took care of.
He did.
You know. Let's talk a bit about structure, because one of the interesting things, and if we could talk about it in terms of the adapting a little bit, because one might think a graphic novel, oh, it's easy, that's a storyboard. And those are your pictures, so you just you just write the graphic novel. But it's not that easy, is it? And the structure of a graphic novel is very different from... Now, Pax Romana, is that a miniseries or like it's a different kind of episode structure, isn't it?
It'll be a miniseries, so we're building it to be 6 hours over 3 nights.
Okay.
And so it's still the same story structure as a 1 hour television show.
Right.
But we'll end up kind of smushing two together for one night, and then we'll tell basically 6 episodes of the course of 3 nights.
But a graphic novel does not have that 1 hour structure.
No. It's got its own interesting structure, like a comic structure. Is a 20-page structure with splash pages and their own sort of built-in act breaks. And it's a different style of attention that you want to get from someone. In TV, in broadcast TV, you are trying to get through the commercial. You know, you want people to keep watching through the commercials. In comics, you want people to keep flipping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you want people who are going to pick up that comic in a shop and flip through the first pages and be interested enough to want to buy that issue. And then that issue's good enough that they come back for the next issue, and on and on and on and on and on. And so you want to have kind of like a good balance of both of those things. You want it to be the thing that when someone loves the graphic novel, they're going to watch the show and they're going to get what they want from the source material. But at the same time, you are finding ways to tell the story in the new medium, which is the, you know, the sci-fi miniseries, that is interesting and new, and someone who's never read the comic or doesn't know anything about it can watch it and think that shit's pretty cool and great too.
Wow. It's not easy.
No.
How did the did that digging into Pax Romana,
mm-hmm,
and some of the other graphic novels you do, I mean, was how helpful was that as far as developing Dead Squad as a comic book?
I think it was great. I think that structurally it helped that Matt had worked so much on the Jericho comics.
Mm-hmm.
And then also that I have just spent a lifetime reading comics.
Right.
And so you have the sort of built-in, I know how this is supposed to feel as I read it. But Dead Squad is coming out in issues, and then it will be put out as one graphic novel, and you want to make sure that people are getting the feeling at the end of each issue that they're getting a full story, but at the same time they want to come back for more story, I think. And it's a thing, by the way, that we took into TV, which is the Stan Lee school of storytelling, and it is the idea that at any given point someone is picking up that issue of Spider-Man for the very first time, and they may know everything about Spider-Man from TV. They may not know anything about it except that guy's costume looks cool. And so it needs to make sense for them as well as it needs, yeah, to be satisfying for the people who've been reading Spider-Man their whole lives.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I think that that is something that, and again, don't get excited, readers, but I think that's something that certain elements of fandom kind of forget. You know, I mean, I see it in the world of Doctor Who, of people who are mad at fans because they didn't have the temerity to be alive when Tom Baker was the Doctor. And it's like, guys, they, you know, what they're doing in the new series is catching up. And there's a lot of stories, like, you know, that get criticism of, oh, well, we've seen this in Doctor Who before. And it's like, yeah, but the 14-year-old kid at home is not seen it. It's brand new. And it's got it. Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about a show like that, which is well over 50 years old, that freshness is absolutely vital, because you can, in certain shows, and I'm not going to name some of the ones that are on today that I, well, anyway, don't speak to me, it can become snakes eating their own tail.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, listen, Roger Moore is great. He is some people's favorite Bond. He's some people's least favorite Bond, mm-hmm, because those movies were made at a certain time. And if Bond movies were still made that way now, I don't think they would be nearly as popular as they are now. And they have the ability to sort of reboot that franchise every time they bring a new person in, to reset what Bond is in terms of what the world is like at that time. And I think it's really valuable. And I think Doctor Who's got a little of that too, where, yeah, it needs to adapt with the times.
That's absolutely right. And like, that's another one, another series I'm rewatching recently. And it's like, I actually like Thunderball a little bit more than Goldfinger. But you couldn't structure a movie like that these days. And not in a big bad studio way, but literally just for the audience.
Oh, I completely agree. It's always great to go back and watch old movies and see how, first of all, they could get away with murder, and you know, structurally,
yeah,
but also see how when the true classics like Casablanca,
oh please, oh,
nearly
favorite,
perfect story structure.
Casablanca is my favorite movie ever made. I've seen it about 100 times, and you see it in so many movies after it.
Yep,
not by accident.
And Hitchcock was great at structure as well. And you can see that in my favorite Hitchcock is, it's actually, I shouldn't say it's my favorite, but one of my favorites is Rear Window.
I love it.
It's hard to pick a favorite. Again, great story structure.
But within those movies, when I think of Hitchcock, and I think of Casablanca, you know, of all the gin joints in all the world, she had a walk in a mind. That's not just a great line. That is also the root of that character. That is the root of his tragedy. That's the root of his misery. That is the root of his entire drama. And the fact that he's torn and loves this woman but wants to be left in peace because she knows she has another man. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are stories that, and it can't be overstated. 9 times out of 10, I feel like maybe 8 times out of 10, a lot of story notes and structure and problems within a script are answered by taking a real close look at the characters, what they're after, what they want, and if that's coming through honestly and clearly.
Yeah, and also not being afraid to have to step away from, for us as writers, I love when I'm stuck on a story problem, and it's generally a character problem, I don't have the solution, I won't go watch a movie that's like the movie we're writing. I will go watch a movie that's nothing like the movie, so I can sort of get out of my own sort of logjam or gridlock of what I think structure is, and watch a movie that's got a structure that works and is a Casablanca's again great example. It's a love story. It's not about a guy with who owns a bar and the French Resistance.
No,
it's a guy choosing love, and by choosing love, he's letting the girl go, and that's great.
And another one where he, like, quote-unquote, loses
in
the end. He doesn't get what he wants. He makes the sacrifice.
Yeah.
Tell us, though, a little bit more about Dead Squad and what it actually is about. Because I know you said it's like existential military.
Yeah, so the first issue's out now, and I guess probably the second will be very close to when this airs. And the idea is, like I said, it's a team of Special Forces soldiers. They've been working together for a long time. They're on a mission. They are betrayed by their commander. They are killed, and they wake up in an army lab, and they realize that they are the now living experiment of this nanotechnology that they've been injected with that's keeping them alive long enough to go solve the mystery of why their boss went rogue. And what's great about it is not only are they they're the test subject, like they're the first human trials on this thing, so pieces of their body aren't working just right. They can also use their body as a tool. So in one moment, you can have the doctor jack up your adrenaline to rip the hinges off a door that's locked, but then it's going to tear all the tendons in your arm, and your left arm isn't going to work for the next 10 minutes while the nanotechnology is rebuilding the tendons in your arm. And so the technology gives and takes in a very real way that feels like it's not science fiction, but it's just real enough to believe. If you saw a thing on 60 Minutes about it, you'd be like, that sounds pretty plausible to me.
Well, some of the stuff that's coming out that people are looking at R&D-wise is just wild. You know, and I hope a lot of it comes true because it could really help with certain environmental things. Now, but to go back to Death Squad for a second, though, I mean, this is the type of story that it sounds very now. These soldiers didn't sign up for this, right?
No, they didn't realize they were playing for the wrong team when they were on the missions they were on.
So these guys are in for all kinds of shocks. So yeah, they're almost. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and they're all dealing with it in different ways. So when the three guys wake up, each of them. I'm saying you can't see my air quotes, but they saw something different when they were dead. And one guy saw heaven, one guy saw hell, one guy saw the complete emptiness of nothing, and they all react differently. And then there's the doctor who's there with them saying, guys, you didn't see anything. That was the synapses in your brains firing in the last moment of your, you know, it's like you had a dream, basically. But try telling that to the guy who saw hell and now is staring down a bad guy with a gun, and normally what he would do is snap that guy's neck, but he doesn't. He's afraid to do that now because he doesn't want to go to hell when it's all over.
Yeah, I you know, how does that doctor know?
And that's what's great about it. It's that, and so all those arguments are happening on the page.
This is very grim, heavy stuff you're playing with here, and I know you're not playing, but you know what I mean. This is some grim, heavy things. But at the same time, if I was 13, I'd be fascinated by this.
Yeah.
You know.
And it's one of those things that you don't think about when you're watching movies where, like, John McClane doesn't have a lot of remorse for all the, like, John McClane kills a lot of dudes.
Yeah.
You know?
But is this something that, like, do you have a specific demographic in mind that you're trying to reach? Like, do you think this is, like, early teenagers, or do you think this is, nope, this is mature audiences only kind of thing?
I don't know. I feel like everything Fatima and I do, we are always trying to kind of get the biggest reach. We're both very unapologetically fans of Spielberg and Lucas and Zemeckis, and we are not trying to make niche movies. We are trying to make big, broad things where we always talked about we want to be making the TV show where everybody in the family sits down around the TV, be it kid, dad, mom, grandpa, like we did when we were kids growing up.
Right.
And how we would all, you know, Magnum was on, we would all sit around the TV watching.
No, outstanding. Well, I'm just with Dead Squad specifically because it's it's violent and it's again, it stops and thinks. But, like, you know, I remember, like, reading Clive Barker in high school and things like that. And it's, I think that, you know, 13, 14, 15 is at a good age where people should be exposed to some of these things. Because, look, they're going to be thinking about it anyway.
Yeah, and the thing we're trying to do is have a light touch with it, too, where it doesn't feel like it's oppressive. And it doesn't feel like we are beating anyone over the head with a moral. We're just saying, hey, will you ever think about what would happen if this happened and how that might mess with your head a little bit? And it might change the way you think about something in a moment. And we do like that the response we've gotten from the people who've read it. We, you know, Matt and I have done a lot of shows and films with sort of like the real versions of these guys. And one in particular has been very helpful to us along the way and telling us, like, because he's a nerd himself. Hey, Dutch, this is a shout out to you. He's really great because he's not only a bad motherfucker who you don't mess with, he is also secretly a very, very literate nerd. Mm-hmm. And so he's great to talk about because you don't need to put things in terms of this is how a warrior sees the world. You can be like, hey, remember that one X-Men where blah, blah, blah? And you're like, oh, yeah, 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 totally understand. So what you guys want to do is you want to think of it this way. And it's a really great character because these guys are not all just sort of a gun-toting thugs putting steel on target. They're guys that have interests and they're curious and they're always learning. And that's the kind of thing we want to portray.
We've been hearing that, like, print and comics and all this stuff is slowly dying, and yet I don't know if that's accurate. What does your experience in the comic world tell you about the future of comics, and especially in terms of now we have new delivery devices and iPads, tablets, and phones, things like that?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm just like every time I hear blank is dying, I don't necessarily believe it because I started in TV when they said. There'll never be a serialized TV. Everything's got to be.
I remember.
Yeah, everything's got to be structured to be contained episodes, and then it shifted, and now there'll never be contained episodes again. There'll never be ever episodic TV. It'll all be like one sustained story, and it's cyclical. The sitcom is dead. The sitcom's back.
And I totally agree.
I generally there. That's something that I can't really control, and so all I can do is an artist is. Just get into the shit I'm into and do the best version of that shit I can and hope that at the end of the day I'm going to reach the people that I want to reach. And I truly don't think that much about who is the audience for this thing because selfishly the audience is always me.
Yeah.
And it's me at every stage of my life where it would be me now as a 30-something-year-old man. It would be college me. It would be 12-year-old me. Like, I would be into this no matter what. Like, how I've aged... But I've always been into James Bond because there's always something about that character that appeals to me, whether it's cool gadgets when you're younger, whether it's the ladies when you're a little older, or when it's the like complicated political storylines or the effect that your job has on your relationships with people as you get older and older.
I think you're absolutely right. I love that you said that. And I've said that a bunch of times on social media because it's true. For a lot of people, sometimes say, like aspiring writers will sometimes say, ah, well, who would want to read my story? Mm-hmm. Look, if you are compelled to tell it, chances are somebody out there will read that story. And I think that your analogy there of like yourself is true. You know, other people just like you, people who have the same like-minded interests and or struggles and or philosophies will absolutely want to hear that story.
And I would encourage everyone out there who is a writer to not chase the thing that they think will sell. They should just write the thing that they know because the truth is that there's, you can't beat the truth.
Yeah.
And when you start from a place of truth, it is always more interesting than when you start from a place of, oh, I just want to tell this story about a fish because fish movies do really well, you know? And so I think that is something I would say to anybody who is struggling with, like, what's, you know, how do I break in as a writer? How do I do that? Like, write a story about something you love.
Yeah.
And it'll come across on the page. It really will. And by the way, structure you can be taught. Dialogue you can learn. It is, there's something about the, like, approaching it from that, like, first bit of, like, this is a true thing that I love more than anything else. Starting with that passion, everything else you're able to kind of knock all that other stuff in place with good notes and a supportive structure and being in the right place at the right time and preparation meeting opportunity.
That's so awesome. And I just want to add to that, Steve. And I may have mentioned this on the show before and probably will again because it's worth repeating. I was told that exact same piece of advice in 2009 or something like that by almost not verbatim, but the same thing of like, don't write something that will sell, write something that you believe in, write something from your heart, by a former agent who all he cared about was making sales. And he told me that. But he knew the smarts was like, no. If you just try to pander to us, we're not going to buy it. You got to write something that's going to move me. And that's coming from like the guy who's only caring about money and sales. So that is absolutely the best advice out there. Tell your story from your heart, your soul, your guts. That's how you're going to sell something because that's what's going to move people.
Mm-hmm. Completely agree.
Yep. Outstanding.
And it was great to hear you and Sundy talking about it on one of the previous episodes. Because you can tell when Sundy talks about Santagate, he's a guy who just thought that'd be a cool idea for a story. And now he's in that phase where he's starting to reap the rewards of like he's taken the time, he's done all this great work, he is a super talented, smart guy who is now taking this idea that he is passionate about, because he's probably gotten 1,000 rounds of notes from the harsh critics in his you know reading group to the people outside of his group he feels a little bit more maybe nervous to give his material to, and he's taking from them, he is using some notes, he's leaving some notes behind because he knows the story he wants to tell, and now it's paying off for him. And I think that's really great. I think it's good to know your own story.
Yeah, I think that's a great point too, and maybe we could touch on a sec. We're coming close on time, but I'd love to explore the idea of notes and reads and stuff like that, because I've had a couple of instances. I think every writer, you know, it's always good to have a trusted circle.
Mm-hmm.
You can't give it to like everybody because you're going to go crazy.
Yeah,
and notes.
And also going back to the thing you and Sundy were talking about, you can't give it to everybody at once. You have your rings of note givers.
Yeah.
Where. You know certain people need to read it at a certain point so they can give you the best notes. This is the structure person. This is the visual person. This is the emotional arc person. And you give it to them at the right point where they're going to be able to tap in and access what you're trying to do, and you can get the most out of them as a reader. Because you only get to fire that gun once for each person.
So let's talk about real quick, though, if we can. Mm-hmm. Like the reader who – or the screenwriter who's, let's say, in Iowa, they're – thousands of miles away from Hollywood, they don't have access to like informed readers or screenwriters. Mm-hmm. So they put a script on the blacklist. It's a great idea. They wrote it from their heart, and the blacklist gives it like a 3 out of 10 or a 4 out of 10, and just absolutely gives page after page of page of notes. How does that writer not get discouraged? What would your advice to him be, or her?
I would say two things to that writer. The first thing I would say is the job of any professional writer is a lot of taking notes. You don't write a story and hand the script to someone and someone says, great, we're going to make this page for page. It is a relentless, constant rewriting, tweaking, changing. Some are bigger than others. You might get the biggest note, way, way down the line that restructures your whole act one. And part of the job of being a good professional writer and producer is being able to roll with all that and being able to know, again, if you started from the place where this is a story that I need to tell, none of that's going to knock your story into a place that's untellable, it will be frustrating because you've been with this version of it for so long. But if you start in the right spot, it's all adjustments that you can make along the way. And so when you get a 3 out of 10 on the blacklist, don't be discouraged because that's the job. But also, I truly believe this, there is no such thing as a bad note. And anyone who's reading your script, you have to trust that they are reading it with helping you in mind. So for us with Pax Romana, it's the story of a group of special forces mercenaries who go back in time to take over ancient Rome. And if you aren't into ancient Rome or special forces soldiers or time travel stories, you are already not exactly my prime demographic. I would prefer you to be into more than one of those. I'd settle for you being into one of them, but that person's going to give you notes from the perspective of, I just don't really dig any of this stuff anyway. If they say, instead of it being time travel, I wish it could be about a magical elf and a flying horse, and you're like, that's not exactly what I'm trying to do. But what they're saying is, there's something in this story which I cannot access this.
Yeah.
And so there is a good note in there, which is, try to find one little thing you can do to your story that can make it more accessible for someone like that, where they're like, you know, normally I'm not into stories about time travel, ancient Rome, or mercenaries, but there was something about it that was really cool. Just like, I guarantee you, someone who saw Rocky and was trying to convince a friend of theirs to go see this movie that has no star in it and has very little actual boxing in it. I read the rules. I heard there's no real boxing in it. Yeah, I'm telling you, man. It's really good. And I'm not even into boxing movies or that guy Sylvester Stallone, but that shit, you gotta go see it. Because you be tapped into that thing and that person they just didn't know that they wanted to get from it.
I think that's such a great point, because notes don't come from a vacuum.
Yeah.
You know, there's something in there. And sometimes, you know, we've talked about this before on the show, like, you know, oh, I hate page 15. I hate the scene on page 15. But, well, maybe it's not page 15. Maybe it's the setup on page 7.
Absolutely.
And the payoff is fine, but the setup is all wrong. Or maybe your dialogue is wrong. Maybe, I mean, I've had people say that to me where, and I thought it was perfect, and then I was like, oh, your motivations in Act 2 are all wrong. No, they're not. Oh, my God, they are.
Right.
It's. I think every note is always worth exploring. It doesn't come from a vacuum.
Yeah.
I agree with you, too, that, like, you shouldn't change the essence of your story. But I think that's really great advice, to try to find another doorway in. You know, maybe there's nothing wrong with the living room, but the front door is in the wrong spot. They need a sliding door to get in the side.
And there's nothing really more satisfying as a writer when you're given a note that's like, oh, there's no way. This is a show killer. I don't understand it. And you spend the first couple minutes bitching about it.
Always,
because that's part of your process. And then you spend the next couple minutes being like, God, I know I got to solve it. And then you spend the next couple minutes saying things like, okay, listen, I may be totally on glue, but what if there isn't even a door? And what if it isn't even a room? What if you're outside and everything changes? And there's that really sort of like, in my mind, the magical moment where you have this sort of the picture, the movie is playing in your head. And then the characters stay in the same spot, but like the holodeck in Star Trek, the entire environment they're in changes. And it just suddenly, everything gets so much smoother. And it's a breakthrough that you didn't even know you needed to have, that this person gave to you by giving you a very specific note on something that you thought didn't matter.
I got to tell you, I didn't say this to Mike, but Mike Sunday gave me a note one time that made me so mad. And I was sitting there, I was like, oh, that note is terrible. And sure enough, like 3 weeks into the rewrites, he gave me a great set of notes, but this one note just, I was like, nope, 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 nope. And sure enough, like 3 weeks into the rewrite, I'm like, oh, fuck, he's absolutely right. I told him that story when we met in person. But
and it's always those notes, too, that are hanging there. Like, they're always just sort of like, to me, like, that's a person standing in the room, just sort of arms crossed watching you type. And I'm like, fucking, I know you're there. Just, you know, fucking leave me alone. I will deal with you. And then all of a sudden you come across one other bump and you solve that bump. And suddenly that person in the corner, the imaginary person in the corner, is nodding at you. And you're like, oh, my God, I think I just solved that thing. And there's, by the way, I love it because Matt and I, we don't write in the same room together. We'll write separately.
Mm-hmm.
And One of my favorite joys is when we'll have a phone call and we'll get a note and neither of us will know what to do about it. And Matt will be really bummed out about it because, it is like, you know, we're saying like, it's a big change. It's a tough fix to make. And we'll say, okay, listen, let's talk about it a little bit. Then let's go away. Let's figure it out. Let's think about it. We'll one of us will figure it out. It'll be okay. And then 2 hours later, the phone rings. And it's a whole different Matt Fetterman on the phone. And I'm like, oh, he's motherfucking got it.
Yeah.
And he always starts the same way. It's always the same conversation. Okay. I may be on glue, but what if it's blah, 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 blah. And I'm not joking. 92% of the time, that goes in the script and it doesn't get changed.
Wow.
Because it's just like, you just know when you have gotten outside the zone enough to come at it from a different way. And you loosen up your grip and the solution presents itself and you're like, oh man, that's perfect.
And the thing about this is that's how, gosh, I don't want to sound too highfalutin about it, but that's how great scripts happen and come about. They don't just magically appear on the page. There is a process to this stuff. And Steve, you were the first person to use the phrase to me of going from an artist one day to being an engineer the next.
Right.
And that has stuck with me because it's like, that's absolutely right. Well, one day we're artists and we're creative and we're in our imaginations and anything goes. But then we have to present that to the people who are going to understand it. And that's when the engineering comes in.
Yeah.
Something that happens to me with some of these notes, this kind of happened with Mike, was like, I was like, that note is wrong. That note is absolutely wrong. And like for 2 weeks, I'm like, that note is wrong. He's wrong. And I'm going to show him. And then it turned into the thought went from that note is wrong to why the hell did he give that note? What the hell is his problem giving that note? And then it's like, wait, why did he give that note? Oh, and it slowly turns into like answering that question of like, oh, that's what he's seeing, and that's why that note happened. Because nobody's going to make a perfect screenplay, but you want things to be as smooth. You used great phrases before, like truth. I love you saying honesty, and the quality vision there as much as possible. And it's a hard process to get there. It's a hard road. And it should be, you know.
Yeah.
I may regret that next week with my next set of notes, but
but
that's the way it goes.
It's satisfying when you give that script to the. For us, when we're doing things professionally, we're writing and rewriting for generally the same people all the time, and it's really great when you find when someone gives you that note that you feel like is a show killer on page 15, and you don't want to fix it on page 15, and you figured out the way to fix it on page 7, like you said, and they give you give it to them to read, and they come back with a note of, I really love how you fixed my problem. And you're like, yeah, that's right. I totally did. Because you get underneath it. And, you know, executives they're not trying to make your life miserable. They truly are trying to do the same thing you're doing, which is make the best thing possible. But their goals are maybe a little different than yours, meaning that you're trying to make the thing as creatively good as possible. And they're saying, business-wise, we creatively want to be good, but we want to be successful. And when you can trust that they're trying to give you the good note, and you can show them the respect of, they give you a note that's like, I really don't, you know, I'm not sure how this works and I can't give you the answer. And then you not only address their note, but you give them the way, you explain to them why they were feeling the way they were feeling. It's great because the next round of notes, they're a lot more willing to give you the rope that you need to roll that story out a little bit more. I think that's when stuff gets really great.
When the trust, yeah.
Yeah, like Breaking Bad was so great because he earned that trust and he didn't spend his currency, you know? He saved it up and he was very spendthrift with the like, no, I'm going to try this thing. I think it's going to work, and then it does. I'm sure he got all kinds of pushback, but at a certain point the studio and the network were like, listen, he and his writers have a really good sense of where the show is going. Let's help them make that show and not try to make them make the show we think it should be.
I got two thoughts I want to just jump off there, and then we'll have to wrap it up. But like I think I told this once before with the producer on an independent producer on a script. He kept giving a note, and we kept not doing it. And we kept not changing it because we really believed in it. And by the end of it, he said, you know something? You've done every other note. I'm going to give you this one. You guys are obviously right. You know what I mean? Like, if you really believe that strongly in it, and we're like, we do. And it was just one line, but it was a line we felt was really important for the script. And I said to him, look, if we ever get the movie made, we'll shoot it and we can cut it in the editing room. We'll revisit it then. And but because I never fought him on anything else, I always had conversations and dialogues. He's like, man, you really believe in this one, don't you? It's that currency you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So when I said, no, I really want to keep this, he said, let's keep it then. Because I wasn't being unreasonable. Mm-hmm. That's the way it goes. And I'm going to say something that you just said, but I'm going to say a lot more mean to all the screenwriters out there. We need to remember that executives' jobs are not to tell us how brilliant we are. Executives' jobs are to run networks, sell shows, program these networks, and make money. We're part of the commerce. I think what you described right there, that's what makes a professional writer. We are professionals. We have a craft. We are applying our craft in the marketplace.
And by the way, you don't know what their job is. That when they're giving you a note, you don't necessarily know what meeting they just came out of where it was like, listen, this thing tanked and we need a thing that's this instead of that. And so they think there's a way to make your project solve a problem for them instead of causing a problem for them.
Absolutely right. And there was, there was a science fiction film franchise and they brought in a very noted sci-fi author. I'm not going to say which one it was, but it might have been Star Trek. And when they brought in a very noted sci-fi author for the motion picture and he presented a treatment and the studio, Paramount read the treatment and said, wow, this is pretty good. And they gave some notes and he stormed out of the room and he's like, how dare you? And I don't recall seeing his name on a lot of the screenplays and treatments after 1979, and probably for that reason of like, no, dude, it's not about just recognizing a screenwriter or writer's brilliance.
It's about collaborative, delivering
a product, delivering a story. Now, of course, we all want our stories to be as pure and true as possible, but as many great shows out there, use Breaking Bad as an example, the popularity of Jericho and Warehouse 13 and a lot of shows that you've worked on and that are out there prove that, yes, we can find quality. It can happen within those circumstances with understanding where, like you said, where are the executives? Like you have to walk into a studio and network and understanding. This kind of goes back to what you were talking about with the comic book of the different pressures. Working on the pressures of selling a comic book Death Squad are very different than the pressures of selling the show Human Target. If you understand those differences, you're going to fare off a lot better.
Yep, agreed.
All right. Steven Skaya, Dead Squad. It is on the comic book stands now. Go out and pick up a
That's it?
Copy.
We're at the end? We're plugging already?
We're at the end, yeah. We're in an hour. Okay. Well, Halloween. What scary movie should everybody watch? It's Halloween's coming up.
To me, I still think the scariest movie as a Catholic is still The Exorcist. The version with the creepy spider leg one. Yeah. Oh my god, that I don't sleep for days after I see that.
Yeah, that one stays with me forever, The Exorcist.
And Poltergeist is pretty creepy too.
I love Poltergeist. Poltergeist does not get the credit I think it deserves. And Jerry Goldsmith's score.
Yeah, creepy children singing. About it.
Masterpiece and everything. So, well, we're going to talk a lot more scary movies next week with your friend of mine, Rick Dominicus, who owns, I think, 10,000 horror movies on Blu-ray, or is something out of control. Anyway, Dead Squad is on the newsstands now. If you can't make it to the newsstand, click on the link below. Steven Skaya, thank you so much for taking an hour out of your busy schedule to talk to the Handsome Timothy Express.
My pleasure. Love the show. Keep up the great work.
Absolutely. And there's an actress friend of yours who I know you know quite well, who I'm going to be asking to be on the show one day soon. Hopefully she'll be agreeable. We got all that to forward to. So, yes, next week. And actually, wait a second. Before I let you go, I'm going to the Austin Film Festival this week.
Yeah.
How awesome is the Austin Film Festival? Listen, you're a winner.
I'm telling you, the reason I am where I am today is because of the Austin Film Festival. Winning that festival was one of the things that changed my life. It was what gave Fetterman and I the opportunity to meet with agents here in town. It put us with the agent that is still our agent to this day, the fantastic Ann Blanchard. It's just such a great time. We go back every once in a while to be a part of panels and sort of be the one of the success stories to come out of there. And it's wonderful. That's where I met Sundy, and then you met Sundy.
Yeah.
It's a magical place. And by the way, is there anything better than like getting drunk at the Driscoll with other awesome writers and them telling crazy cool stories? Like, I mean, I think my favorite Austin Film Festival memory was I was getting in the elevator at the Driscoll to go, I forget where I was going, and Shane Black gets in the elevator. And of course, I'm a nerd, so I know who Shane Black is. And, you know, we're riding up a couple floors. I'm like, I got to say something because, like, come on. And I said, oh, you know, I just, you know, want you to know, very big admirer. I really appreciate your work. And he's like, hey, that's cool, man. What's your name? And I introduced myself. What are you doing here? Oh, you know, I'm here. I'm a finalist and I won the festival. And he's like, that's awesome. You want to go get a drink? Let's go down to the bar. And we sat at the bar and he told great, awesome Predator stories. And it was fantastic.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's what happens at Austin.
Yeah. There's a merge of aspiring and established and veteran where it's one of the few places you can go to where you're all in the same boat.
Yeah.
And you're
safe
all just
be
writers.
A fan. Yeah. And everyone is. Yeah.
But even, and just like to sometimes ask like, hey, what do I do in Act Two when this happens? Sometimes, you know, like I've noticed people just talking about kind of the nuts and bolts. Because one of the hardest things about being a writer is that unless you're a writer, it's very hard for people to understand what you do. It's very hard to understand. Like I remember talking to Fetterman one time, a story. He might find this funny. I talked to him at a party, and he was talking about how he will absolutely rewrite his action lines to make sure there's not one line, like a one-word line. You know, so if it's like three lines and one word goes to the third line, he'll like rewrite it to make sure there's no, it's just two clean lines.
Absolutely.
And when he told me that, I was so grateful because I was like, oh my God, I'm not crazy.
Yeah,
because
makes sense.
And not a lot of people understand the way we play with words and the way we do this stuff.
Yeah, and it's got to look right on the page when you're reading it. That's part of it. It can't just be a big giant block of text.
Yeah.
It's got to be presentable.
The page almost has to be pretty.
And you can have your own style of how you talk about action, and you can be the Damon Lindelof who's like, he'll literally end an act with, and I just fucking blew your mind.
Yeah.
Or you can just be a really strong, cogent writer that uses very little words like James Ellroy, where it's just like punch, period, kick, period, blood, period. And like, you get it. They both work.
The Alien script is like that. It's fantastic. One of the earlier drafts, the Rockne, the Giler Hill version is like that. Literally, like, alien runs, door opens, space rushes in, and like and it's got this staccato, bam,
I'll
bam,
do a certain thing,
bam,
for sure.
Cool.
Yeah.
You know what I just did on a pilot? We'll talk about this more over beers next time. Is I was having a hard time. I wasn't having that hard a time, but I cracked my description. The description is in the same voice as my main character, so it's almost like a de facto VO. Like you can almost picture my main character saying the descriptions, and it just. Is maybe one of the smoothest reads I've ever established, or one of the smoothest reads I've ever written.
It's always great when you figure out those little tricks for yourself.
Yeah, and that's especially in screenwriting because we don't have 4,000 pages like a novelist. Not that writing a novel is easy; writing a novel is very hard. But we have with the page numbers. You know, I sweat sometimes watching those page numbers creep up. Like, oh shit, you know, and watch how am I going to get to this on this page and that page? We're in very limited time.
Yeah, agreed.
Outstanding. Well, we'll definitely be talking more. Well, maybe when Raven Rock premieres, we'll have you back on. You and Fetterman.
Yeah, six seasons in a movie.
Yeah, outstanding. Rock and roll. Yeah, Raven Rock coming soon on NBC, so just Google that. Steven Sky, once again, thanks so very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, outstanding. This was awesome. And next week, we are going to be exploring deep into the world of horror movies just in time for Halloween with Rick Dominguez. So thank you, dear reader. Thank you, dear listener. Please feel free to share, retweet, and spread the word about this podcast if you enjoyed it. This is Tim Davis on the Handsome Timmy D Express.